I was familiar with the problem. The nanoparticles in the cloud had to be endowed with a rudimentary intelligence so that they could interact with each other to form a flock that wheeled in the air. Such coordinated activity might look pretty intelligent, but it occurred even when the individuals making up the flock were rather stupid. After all, birds and fish could do it, and they weren't the brightest creatures on the planet. Most people watching a flock of birds or a school of fish assumed there was a leader, and that all the other animals followed the leader. That was because human beings, like most social mammals, had group leaders. But birds and fish had no leaders. Their groups weren't organized that way. Careful study of flocking behavior, frame-by-frame video analysis, showed that, in fact, there was no leader. Birds and fish responded to a few simple stimuli among themselves, and the result was coordinated behavior. But nobody was controlling it. Nobody was leading it. Nobody was directing it. Nor were individual birds genetically programmed for flocking behavior. Flocking was not hardwired. There was nothing in the bird brain that said, "When thus and such happens, start flocking." On the contrary, flocking simply emerged within the group as a result of much simpler, low-level rules. Rules like, "Stay close to the birds nearest you, but don't bump into them." From those rules, the entire group flocked in smooth coordination. Because flocking arose from low-level rules, it was called emergent behavior. The technical definition of emergent behavior was behavior that occurred in a group but was not programmed into any member of the group. Emergent behavior could occur in any population, including a computer population, or a robot population, or a nano-swarm. I said to Ricky, "Your problem was emergent behavior in the swarm?" "Exactly. It was unpredictable, to put it mildly." In recent decades, this notion of emergent group behavior had caused a minor revolution in computer science. What that meant for programmers was that you could lay down rules of behavior for individual agents, but not for the agents acting together. Individual agents, whether programming modules or processors, or, as in this case, actual micro-robots, could be programmed to cooperate under certain circumstances and to compete under other circumstances. They could be given goals. They could be instructed to pursue their goals with single-minded intensity, or to be available to help other agents. But the result of these interactions could not be programmed. It just emerged, with often surprising outcomes. In a way, this was very exciting. For the first time, a program could produce results that absolutely could not be predicted by the programmer. These programs behave more like living organisms than man-made automatons. That excited programmers, but it frustrated them too, because the program's emergent behavior was erratic. Sometimes competing agents fought to a standstill, and the program failed to accomplish anything. Sometimes agents were so influenced by one another that they lost track of their goal and did something else instead. In that sense, the program was very childlike, unpredictable, and easily distracted. As one programmer put it, "Trying to program distributed intelligence is like telling a 5-year-old kid to go to his room and change his clothes. He may do that, but he is equally likely to do something else and never return." Because these programs behaved in a lifelike way, programmers began to draw analogies to the behavior of real organisms in the real world. In fact, they began to model the behavior of actual organisms as a way to get some control over program outcomes. So you had programmers studying ant swarming or termite mounding or bee dancing in order to write programs to control airplane landing schedules, or package routing, or language translation. These programs often worked beautifully, but they could still go awry, particularly if circumstances changed drastically. Then they would lose their goals. That was why I began 5 years ago to model predator-prey relationships as a way to keep goals fixed, because hungry predators weren't distracted. Circumstances might force them to improvise their methods, and they might try many times before they succeeded, but they didn't lose track of their goal. So I became an expert in predator-prey relationships. I knew about packs of hyenas, African hunting dogs, stalking lionesses, and attacking columns of army ants. My team had studied the literature from the field biologists, and we had generalized those findings into a program module called PredPrey, which could be used to control any system of agents and make its behavior purposeful, to make the program seek a goal. Looking at Ricky's screen, the coordinated units moving smoothly as they turned through the air, I said, "You used PredPrey to program your individual units?" "Right, we used those rules." "Well, the behavior looks pretty good to me," I said, watching the screen. "Why is there a problem?" "We're not sure." "What does that mean?" "It means we know there's a problem, but we're not sure what's causing it. Whether the problem is programming or something else."
"Something else? Like what?"
I frowned. "I don't get it, Ricky. This is just a cluster of microbots. You can make it do what you want. If the programming's not right, you adjust it."
"What don't I understand?"
Ricky looked at me uneasily. He pushed his chair away from the table and stood.
"Let me show you how we manufacture these agents," he said. "Then you'll understand the situation better."
Having watched Julia's demo tape, I was immediately curious to see what he showed me next, because many people I respected thought molecular manufacturing was impossible. One of the major theoretical objections was the time it would take to build a working molecule. To work at all, the nanoassembly line would have to be far more efficient than anything previously known in human manufacturing. Basically, all man-made assembly lines ran at roughly the same speed. They could add one part per second. An automobile, for example, had a few thousand parts. You could build a car in a matter of hours. A commercial aircraft had 6 million parts, and it took several months to build. But a typical manufactured molecule consisted of 10^25 parts. That was 10, with 25 zeros behind it. As a practical matter, this number was unimaginably large. The human brain couldn't comprehend it. But calculations showed that even if you could assemble at the rate of 1 million parts per second, the time to complete one molecule would still be 3,000 trillion years, longer than the known age of the universe. And that was a problem. It was known as the build time problem. I said to Ricky, "If you're doing industrial manufacturing,"
"We are."
"Then you must have solved the build time problem."
"We have."
"How?"
"Just wait."
Most scientists assumed this problem would be solved by building from larger subunits, molecular fragments consisting of billions of atoms. That would cut the assembly time down to a couple of years. Then, with partial self-assembly, you might get the time down to several hours, perhaps even 1 hour. But even with further refinements, it remained a theoretical challenge to produce commercial quantities of product, because the goal was not to manufacture a single molecule in an hour. The goal was to manufacture several pounds of molecules in an hour. No one had ever figured out how to do that. We passed a couple of laboratories, including one that looked like a standard microbiology lab or a genetics lab. I saw May standing in that lab, puttering around. I started to ask Ricky why he had a microbiology lab here, but he brushed my question aside. He was impatient now, in a hurry. I saw him glance at his watch. Directly ahead was a final glass airlock,
stenciled on the glass door was Microfabrication. Ricky waved me in.
One at a time, he said. That's all the system allows.
I stepped in. The doors hissed shut behind me, the pressure pads again thunking shut. Another blast of air from below, from the sides, from above. By now I was getting used to it. The second door opened, and I walked forward down another short corridor, opening into a large room beyond. I saw bright, shining white light, so bright it hurt my eyes. Ricky came after me, talking as we walked, but I don't remember what he said. I couldn't focus on his words, I just stared, because by now I was inside the main fab building, a huge, windowless space, like a giant hangar 3 stories high. And within this hangar stood a structure of immense complexity that seemed to hang in mid-air, glowing like a jewel. Day 6, 9:12 a.m. At first, it was hard to understand what I was seeing. It looked like an enormous glowing octopus rising above me, with glinting, faceted arms extending outward in all directions, throwing complex reflections and bands of color onto the outer walls. Except this octopus had multiple layers of arms. One layer was low, just a foot above the floor. A second was at chest level. The third and fourth layers were higher, above my head. And they all glowed, sparkled brilliantly. I blinked, dazzled. I began to make out the details. The octopus was contained within an irregular 3-story framework built entirely of modular glass cubes. Floors, walls, ceilings, staircases, everything was cubes. But the arrangement was haphazard, as if someone had dumped a mound of giant transparent sugar cubes in the center of the room. Within this cluster of cubes, the arms of the octopus snaked off in all directions. The whole thing was held up by a web of black anodized struts and connectors, but they were obscured by the reflections, which is why the octopus seemed to hang in midair. Ricky grinned.
Convergent assembly. The architecture is fractal. Neat, huh?
I nodded slowly. I was seeing more details. What I had seen as an octopus was actually a branching tree structure. A central square conduit ran vertically through the center of the room, with smaller pipes branching off on all sides. From these branches, even smaller pipes branched off in turn, and smaller ones still. The smallest of the pipes were pencil thin. Everything gleamed as if it were mirrored.
Why is it so bright?
The glass has diamondoid coating, he said. At the molecular level, glass is like Swiss cheese, full of holes. And, of course, it's a liquid, so atoms just pass right through it.
So you coat the glass?
Right. Have to. Within this shining forest of branching glass, David and Rosie moved, making notes, adjusting valves, consulting handheld computers. I understood that I was looking at a massively parallel assembly line. Small fragments of molecules were introduced into the smallest pipes, and atoms were added to them. When that was finished, they moved into the next largest pipes, where more atoms were added. In this way, molecules moved progressively toward the center of the structure, until assembly was completed, and they were discharged into the central pipe.
Exactly right, Ricky said. This is just the same as an automobile assembly line, except that it's on a molecular scale. Molecules start at the ends and come down the line to the center. We stick on a protein sequence here, a methyl group there, just the way they stick doors and wheels on a car. At the end of the line, off rolls a new, custom-made molecular structure, built to our specifications.
And the different arms?
Make different molecules. That's why the arms look different. In several places, the octopus arm passed through a steel tunnel reinforced with heavy bolts for vacuum ducting. In other places, a cube was covered with quilted silver insulation, and I saw liquid nitrogen tanks nearby. Extremely low temperatures were generated in that section.
"Those are our cryogenic rooms," Ricky said. "We don't go very low, maybe minus 70 centigrade max. Come on, I'll show you."
He led me through the complex, following glass walkways that threaded among the arms. In some places, a short staircase enabled us to step over the lowest arms. Ricky chatted continuously about technical details. Vacuum-jacketed hoses, metal phase separators, globe check valves. When we reached the insulated cube, he opened the heavy door to reveal a small room with a second room adjacent. It looked like a pair of meat lockers. Small glass windows were set in each door. At the moment, everything was at room temperature.
"You can have two different temps here," he said. "Run one from the other, if you want, but it's usually automated."
Ricky led me back outside, glancing at his watch as he did so. I said, "Are we late for an appointment?"
"What? No, no, nothing like that."
Nearby, two cubes were actually solid metal rooms with thick electrical cables running inside. I said, "Those are magnet rooms?"
"That's right," Ricky said. "We've got pulsed field magnets generating 60 Tesla in the core. That's something like a million times the magnetic field of the Earth."
With a grunt, he pushed open the steel door to the nearest magnet room. I saw a large donut-shaped object about 6 feet in diameter, with a hole in the center about an inch wide. The donut was completely encased in tubing and plastic insulation. Heavy steel bolts, running from top to bottom, held the jacketing in place.
"Lots of cooling for this puppy, I can tell you. And a lot of power. 15 kilowatts takes a full minute load time for the capacitors. And, of course, we can only pulse it. If we turned it on continuously, it'd explode, ripped apart by the field it generates."
He pointed to the base of the magnet, where there was a round push button at knee level.
"That's the safety cutoff there," he said. "Just in case. Hit it with your knee if your hands are full."
I said, "So you use high magnetic fields to do part of your assembly?" But Ricky had already turned and headed out the door, again glancing at his watch. I hurried after him.
"Ricky, I have more to show you," he said. "We're getting to the end."
"Ricky, this is all very impressive," I said, gesturing to the glowing arms. "But most of your assembly line is running at room temperature. No vacuum, no cryo. No mag field."
"Right. No special conditions."
"How is that possible?"
He shrugged. "The assemblers don't need it."
"The assemblers?" I said.
"Are you telling me you've got molecular assemblers on this line?" "Yes, of course."
"Assemblers are doing your fabrication for you?"
"Of course. I thought you understood that."
"No, Ricky," I said. "I didn't understand that at all. And I don't like being lied to." He got a wounded look on his face.
"I'm not lying."
But I was certain that he was. One of the first things scientists learned about molecular manufacturing was how phenomenally difficult it was to carry out. In 1990, some IBM researchers pushed xenon atoms around on a nickel plate until they formed the letters IBM in the shape of the company logo. The entire logo was 1/10 billionth of an inch long and could only be seen through an electron microscope. But it made a striking visual, and it got a lot of publicity. IBM allowed people to think it was a proof of concept, the opening of a door to molecular manufacturing. But it was more of a stunt than anything else, because pushing individual atoms into a specific arrangement was slow, painstaking, and expensive work. It took the IBM researchers a whole day to move 35 atoms. Nobody believed you could create a whole new technology in this way. Instead, most people believed that nano-engineers would eventually find a way to build assemblers, miniature molecular machines that could turn out specific molecules, the way a ball-bearing machine turned out ball bearings. The new technology would rely on molecular machines to make molecular products. It was a nice concept, but the practical problems were daunting, because assemblers were vastly more complicated than the molecules they made. Attempts to design and build them had been difficult from the outset. To my knowledge, no laboratory anywhere in the world had actually done it. But now Ricky was telling me, quite casually, that Zymos could build molecular assemblers that were now turning out molecules for the company. And I didn't believe him. I had worked all my life in technology, and I had developed a feel for what was possible. This kind of giant leap forward just didn't happen. It never did. Technologies were a form of knowledge, and like all knowledge, technologies grew, evolved, matured. To believe otherwise was to believe that the Wright brothers could build a rocket and fly to the moon instead of flying 300 feet over sand dunes at Kitty Hawk. Nanotechnology was still at the Kitty Hawk stage. "Come on, Ricky," I said. "How are you really doing this?" "The technical details aren't that important, Jack." "What fresh bullshit is this? Of course they're important." "Jack," he said, giving me his most winning smile, "do you really think I'm lying to you?" "Yes, Ricky," I said. "I do." I looked up at the octopus arms all around me. Surrounded by glass, I saw my own reflection dozens of times in the surfaces around me. It was confusing, disorienting. Trying to gather my thoughts, I looked down at my feet. And I noticed that even though we had been walking on glass walkways, some sections of the ground floor were glass as well. One section was nearby. I walked toward it. Through the glass I could see steel ducting and pipes below ground level. One set of pipes caught my eye because they ran from the storage room to a nearby glass cube, at which point they emerged from the floor and headed upward, branching into the smaller tubes. That, I assumed, was the feedstock, the slush of raw organic material that would be transformed on the assembly line into finished molecules. Looking back down at the floor, I followed the pipes backward to the place where they entered from the adjacent room. This junction was glass, too. I could see the curved steel underbellies of the big kettles I'd noticed earlier, the tanks that I had thought were a microbrewery. Because that's certainly what it had looked like, a small brewery, machinery for controlled fermentation, for controlled microbial growth. And then I realized what it really was. I said, "You son of a bitch." Ricky smiled again and shrugged. "Hey," he said, "it gets the job done." Those kettles in the next room were indeed tanks for controlled microbial growth, but Ricky wasn't making beer. He was making microbes, and I had no doubt about the reason why. Unable to construct genuine nano-assemblers, Zymos was using bacteria to crank out their molecules. This was genetic engineering, not nanotechnology. "Well, not exactly," Ricky said when I told him what I thought. "But I admit we're using a hybrid technology. Not much of a surprise in any case, is it?" That was true. For at least 10 years, observers had been predicting that genetic engineering, computer programming, and nanotechnology would eventually merge. They were all involved with similar and interconnected activities. There wasn't that much difference between using a computer to decode part of a bacterial genome and using a computer to help you insert new genes into the bacteria to make new proteins. and there wasn't much difference between creating a new bacteria to spit out, say, insulin molecules, and creating a man-made micromechanical assembler to spit out new molecules. It was all happening at the molecular level. It was all the same challenge of imposing human design on extremely complex systems. And molecular design was nothing if not complicated. You could think of a molecule as a series of atoms snapped together like Lego blocks, one after another. But the image was misleading, because unlike a Lego set, atoms couldn't be snapped together in any arrangement you liked. An inserted atom was subject to powerful local forces, magnetic and chemical, with frequently undesirable results. The atom might be kicked out of its position. It might remain, but at an awkward angle. It might even fold the entire molecule up in knots. As a result, molecular manufacturing was an exercise in the art of the possible, of substituting atoms and groups of atoms to make equivalent structures that would work in the desired way. In the face of all this difficulty, it was impossible to ignore the fact that there already existed proven molecular factories capable of turning out large numbers of molecules. They were called cells. Unfortunately, cellular manufacturing can take us only so far, Ricky said. We harvest the substrate molecules, the raw materials, and then we build on them with nano-engineering procedures. So we do a little of both. I pointed down at the tanks. What cells are you growing? Theta D 5972, he said. Which is? A strain of E. coli. E. coli was a common bacterium found pretty much everywhere in the natural environment, even in the human intestine. I said, did anyone think it might not be a good idea to use cells that can live inside human beings? Not really, he said. Frankly, that wasn't a consideration. We just wanted a well-studied cell that was fully documented in the literature. We chose an industry standard. Uh-huh. Anyway, Ricky continued, I don't think it's a problem, Jack. It won't thrive in the human gut. Theta D is optimized for a variety of nutrient sources to make it cheap to grow in the laboratory. In fact, I think it can even grow on garbage. So that's how you get your molecules. Bacteria make them for you. Yes, he said. That's how we get the primary molecules. We harvest 27 primary molecules. They fit together in relatively high temperature settings where the atoms are more active and mix quickly. That's why it's hot in here. Yes, reaction efficiency has a maxima at 147 degrees Fahrenheit, so we work there. That's where we get the fastest combination rate. But these molecules will combine at much lower temperatures. Even around 35, 40 degrees Fahrenheit, you'll get a certain amount of molecular combination. And you don't need other conditions? I said. Vacuum, pressure, high magnetic fields? Ricky shook his head. No, Jack, we maintain those conditions to speed up assembly, but it's not strictly necessary. The design is really elegant. The component molecules go together quite easily. And these component molecules combine to form your final assembler? Which then assembles the molecules we want, yes. It was a clever solution, creating his assemblers with bacteria. But Ricky was telling me the components assembled themselves almost automatically, with nothing required but high temperature. What, then, was this complex glass building used for? Efficiency and process separation, Ricky said. We can build as many as 9 assemblers simultaneously in the different arms. And where do the assemblers make their final molecules? In this same structure, but first we reapply them. I shook my head. I wasn't familiar with the term. Reapply? It's a little refinement we developed here. We're patenting it. You see, our system worked perfectly right from the start. but our yields were extremely low. We were harvesting half a gram of finished molecules an hour. At that rate, it would take several days to make a single camera. We couldn't figure out what the problem was. The late assembly in the arms is done in gas phase. It turned out that the molecular assemblers were heavy and tended to sink to the bottom. The bacteria settled on a layer above them, releasing component molecules that were lighter still and floated higher. So the assemblers were making very little contact with the molecules they were meant to assemble. We tried mixing technologies, but they didn't help.
So you did what?
We modified the assembler design to provide a lipotrophic base that would attach to the surface of the bacteria. That brought the assemblers into better contact with the component molecules. And immediately, our yields jumped 5 orders of magnitude.
And now your assemblers sit on the bacteria?
Correct. They attach to the outer cell membrane.
At a nearby workstation, Ricky punched up the assembler design on a flat panel display. The assembler looked like a sort of pinwheel, a series of spiral arms going off in different directions, and a dense knot of atoms in the center.
It's fractal, as I said, he said. So it looks sort of the same at smaller orders of magnitude.
He laughed.
Like the old joke, turtles all the way down.
He pressed more keys.
Anyway, here's the attached configuration.
The screen now showed the assembler adhering to a much larger pill-shaped object, like a pinwheel attached to a submarine.
That's the Theta D bacterium, Ricky said, with the assembler on it.
As I watched, several more pinwheels attached themselves.
And these assemblers make the actual camera units?
Correct.
He typed again. I saw a new image.
This is our target micromachine, the final camera. You've seen the bloodstream version. This is the Pentagon version, quite a bit larger and designed to be airborne. What you're looking at is a molecular helicopter.
Where's the propeller? I said.
Hasn't got one. The machine uses those little round protrusions you see there, stuck in at angles. Those are motors. The machines actually maneuver by climbing the viscosity of the air.
Climbing the what?
Viscosity of the air.
He smiled.
Micro machine level, remember? It's a whole new world, Jack.
However innovative the design, Ricky was still bound by the Pentagon's engineering specs for the product, and the product wasn't performing. Yes, they had built a camera that couldn't be shot down, and it transmitted images very well. Ricky explained it worked perfectly during tests indoors, but outside, even a modest breeze tended to blow it away like the cloud of dust it was. The engineering team at Zymos was attempting to modify the units to increase mobility, but so far without success. Meanwhile, the Department of Defense decided the design constraints were unbeatable and had backed away from the whole nano concept. The Zymos contract had been canceled. DOD was going to pull funding in another 6 weeks. I said,
that's why Julia was so desperate for venture capital these last few weeks.
Right, Ricky said. Frankly, this whole company could go belly up before Christmas.
Unless you fix the units so they can work in wind.
Right, right.
I said, Ricky, I'm a programmer. I can't help you with your agent mobility problems. That's an issue of molecular design. It's engineering. It's not my area.
I know that. He paused, frowned. But actually, we think the program code may be involved in the solution.
The code? Involved in the solution to what?
Jack, I have to be frank with you. We've made a mistake, he said. But it's not our fault, I swear to you. It wasn't us. It was the contractors.
He started down the stairs.
Come on. I'll show you. Walking briskly, he led me to the far side of the facility, where I saw an open yellow elevator cage mounted on the wall. It was a small elevator, and I was uncomfortable because it was open. I averted my eyes. Ricky said, "Don't like heights? Can't stand them." "Well, it's better than walking." He pointed off to one side, where an iron ladder ran up the wall to the ceiling. "When the elevator goes out, we have to climb up that." I shuddered. "Not me." We rode the elevator all the way up to the ceiling, 3 stories above the ground. Hanging beneath the ceiling was a tangle of ducts and conduits, and a network of mesh walkways to enable workers to service them. I hated the mesh, because I could see through it to the floor below. I tried not to look down. We had to duck repeatedly beneath the low-hanging pipes. Ricky shouted over the roar of the equipment.
"Everything's up here,"
he yelled, pointing in various directions.
"Air handlers over there, water tank for the fire sprinkler system there, electrical junction boxes there. This is really the center of everything."
Ricky continued down the walkway, finally stopping beside a big air vent about 3 feet in diameter that went into the outer wall.
"This is Vent 3, he said, leaning close to my ear. "It's one of 4 main vents that exhausts air to the outside. Now you see those slots along the vent and the square boxes that sit in the slots? Those are filter packs. We have microfilters arranged in successive layers to prevent any external contamination from the facility." "I see them." "You see them now," Ricky said. "Unfortunately, the contractor forgot to install the filters in this particular vent. In fact, they didn't even cut the slots, so the building inspectors never realized anything was missing. They signed off on the building. We started working here, and we vented unfiltered air to the outside environment."
"For how long?"
Ricky bit his lip.
3 weeks.
"And you were at full production?"
He nodded.
"We figure we vented approximately 25 kilos of contaminants."
"And what were the contaminants?"
"A little of everything. We're not sure exactly what."
"So you vented E. coli, assemblers, finished molecules, everything?"
"Correct, but we don't know what proportions."
"Do the proportions matter?"
"They might, yes."
Ricky was increasingly edgy as he told me all this, biting his lip, scratching his head, avoiding my eyes. I didn't get it. In the annals of industrial pollution, 50 pounds of contamination was trivial. 50 pounds of material would fit comfortably in a gym bag, unless it was highly toxic or radioactive, and it wasn't. Such a small quantity simply didn't matter. I said,
"Ricky, so what? Those particles were scattered by the wind across hundreds of miles of desert. They'll decay from sunlight and cosmic radiation. They'll break up, decompose. In a few hours or days, they're gone, right?"
Ricky shrugged.
"Actually, Jack, that's not what..."
It was at that moment that the alarm went off. It was a quiet alarm, just a soft, insistent pinging, but it made Ricky jump. He ran down the walkway, feet clanging on the metal, toward a computer workstation mounted on the wall. There was a status window in the corner of the monitor. It was flashing red, PV 90 entry. I said,
"What does that mean?"
"Something set off the perimeter alarms."
He unclipped his radio and said,
"Vince, lock us down."
The radio crackled.
"We're locked down, Ricky."
"Raise positive pressure."
"It's up 5 pounds above baseline. You want more?"
"No, leave it there. Do we have visualization?"
"Not yet."
"Shit."
Ricky stuck the radio back in his belt, began typing quickly. The workstation screen divided into a half dozen small images from security cameras mounted all around the facility. Some showed the surrounding desert from high views, looking down from rooftops.
Others were ground views. The cameras panned slowly. I saw nothing, just desert scrub and occasional clumps of cactus.
False alarm?
I said. Ricky shook his head.
I wish, I said.
I don't see anything.
It'll take a minute to find it.
Find what?
That.
He pointed to the monitor and bit his lip. I saw what appeared to be a small, swirling cloud of dark particles. It looked like a dust devil, one of those tiny tornado-like clusters that moved over the ground, spun by convection currents rising from the hot desert floor. Except that this cloud was black, and it had some definition. It seemed to be pinched in the middle, making it look a bit like an old-fashioned Coke bottle. But it didn't hold that shape consistently. The appearance kept shifting, transforming.
Ricky, I said, what are we looking at? I was hoping you'd tell me.
It looks like an agent swarm. Is that your camera swarm?
No, it's something else.
How do you know?
Because we can't control it. It doesn't respond to our radio signals.
You've tried?
Yes, we've tried to make contact with it for almost 2 weeks, he said. It's generating an electrical field that we can measure, but for some reason, we can't interact with it.
So you have a runaway swarm?
Yes.
Acting autonomously?
Yes.
And this has been going on for...
days, about 10 days.
10 days? I frowned. How is that possible, Ricky? The swarm's a collection of micro-robotic machines. Why haven't they decayed or run out of power? And why exactly can't you control them? Because if they have the ability to swarm, then there's some electrically mediated interaction among them. So you should be able to take control of the swarm, or at least disrupt it.
All true, Ricky said. Except we can't, and we've tried everything we could think of.
He was focused on the screen, watching intently.
That cloud is independent of us, period.
And so you brought me out here
to help us get the fucking thing back,
Ricky said. Day 6, 9:32 a.m. It was, I thought, a problem no one had ever imagined before. In all the years that I had been programming agents, the focus had been on getting them to interact in a way that produced useful results. It never occurred to us that there might be a larger control issue or a question of independence, because it simply couldn't happen. Individual agents were too small to be self-powered. They had to get their energy from some external source, such as a supplied electrical or microwave field. All you had to do was turn off the field, and the agents died. The swarm was no more difficult to control than a household appliance, like a kitchen blender. Flip the power off, and it went dead. But Ricky was telling me this cloud had been self-sustaining for days. That just didn't make sense. Where is it getting power? He sighed.
We built the units with a small piezo wafer to generate current from photons. It's only supplementary. We added it as an afterthought. But they seem to be managing with it alone.
So the units are solar-powered? I said.
Right.
Whose idea was that?
The Pentagon asked for it.
And you built in capacitance?
Yeah, they can store charge for 3 hours.
Okay, fine, I said. Now we were getting somewhere. So they have enough power for 3 hours. What happens at night?
At night, they presumably lose power after 3 hours of darkness.
And then the cloud falls apart.
Yes.
And the individual units drop to the ground.
Presumably, yes.
Can't you take control of them then?
We could, Ricky said, if we could find them. We go out every night looking, but we can never find them.
You've built in markers?
Yeah, sure. Every single unit has a fluorescing module in the shell. they show up blue-green under UV light.
So you go out at night looking for a patch of desert that glows blue-green.
Right. And so far we haven't found it.
That didn't really surprise me. If the cloud collapsed tightly, it would form a clump about 6 inches in diameter on the desert floor. And it was a big desert out there. They could easily miss it, night after night. But as I thought about it, there was another aspect that didn't make sense. Once the cloud fell to the ground, once the individual units lost power, then the cloud had no organization. It could be scattered by wind, like so many dust particles, never to reform. But evidently, that didn't happen. The units didn't scatter. Instead, the cloud returned day after day. Why was that?
"We think," Ricky said, "that it may hide at night."
"Hide?"
"Yeah, we think it goes to some protected area, maybe an overhang or a hole in the ground, something like that."
I pointed to the cloud as it swirled toward us.
"You think that swarm is capable of hiding?" "I think it's capable of adapting. In fact, I know it is."
He sighed.
"Anyway, it's more than just one swarm, Jack."
"There's more than one?"
"There's at least three, maybe more by now."
I felt a momentary blankness, a kind of sleepy gray confusion that washed over me. I suddenly couldn't think. I couldn't put it together.
"What are you saying?" "I'm saying it reproduces, Jack," he said. "The fucking swarm reproduces."
The camera now showed a ground-level view of the dust cloud as it swirled toward us. But as I watched, I realized it wasn't swirling like a dust devil. Instead, the particles were twisting one way, then another, in a kind of sinuous movement. They were definitely swarming. Swarming was a term for the behavior of certain social insects, like ants or bees, which swarmed whenever the hive moved to a new site. A cloud of bees will fly in one direction and then another, forming a dark river in the air. The swarm might halt and cling to a tree for perhaps an hour, perhaps overnight, before continuing onward. Eventually, the bees settled on a new location for their hive and stopped swarming. In recent years, programmers had written programs that modeled this insect behavior. Swarm intelligence algorithms had become an important tool in computer programming. To programmers, a swarm meant a population of computer agents that acted together to solve a problem by distributed intelligence. Swarming became a popular way to organize agents to work together. There were professional organizations and conferences devoted entirely to swarm intelligence programs. Lately, it had become a kind of default solution. If you couldn't code anything more inventive, you made your agents swarm. But as I watched, I could see this cloud was not swarming in any ordinary sense. The sinuous back-and-forth motion seemed to be only part of its movement. There was also a rhythmic expansion and contraction, a pulse, almost like breathing. And intermittently, the cloud seemed to thin out and rise higher, then to collapse down and become more squat. These changes occurred continuously, but in a repeating rhythm, or rather a series of superimposed rhythms.
"Shit," Ricky said. "I don't see the others, and I know it's not alone."
He pressed the radio again.
"Vince, you see any others?"
"No, Ricky."
"Where are the others? Guys, speak to me."
Radios crackled all over the facility. Bobby Lembeck.
"Ricky, it's alone."
"It can't be alone."
May Chang.
"Ricky, nothing else is registering out there."
"Just one swarm, Ricky."
That was David Brooks.
"It can't be alone."
Ricky was gripping the radio so tightly his fingers were white. He pressed the button.
"Vince, take the PPI up to 7.
"You sure?"
do it.
Well, all right, if you really think...
Just skip the fucking commentary and do it.
Ricky was talking about increasing the positive pressure inside the building to 7 pounds per square inch. All clean facilities maintained a positive pressure so that outside dust particles could not enter from any leak. They would be blown outward by the escaping air. But 1 or 2 pounds was enough to maintain that. 7 pounds of positive pressure was a lot. It was unnecessary to keep out passive particles. But, of course, these particles weren't passive. Watching the cloud swirl and undulate as it came closer, I saw that parts of it occasionally caught the sunlight in a way that turned it a shimmering, iridescent silver. Then the color faded, and the swarm became black again. That had to be the piezo panels catching the sun. But it clearly demonstrated that the individual micro-units were highly mobile, since the entire cloud never turned silver at the same time, but only portions or bands. I thought you said the Pentagon was giving up on you because you couldn't control the swarm and wind.
Right, we couldn't.
But you must have had a strong wind in the last few days.
Of course. Usually comes up in late afternoon. We had 10 knots yesterday.
Why wasn't the swarm blown away?
Because it's figured that one out,
Ricky said gloomily.
It's adapted to it.
How?
Keep watching. You'll probably see it. Whenever the wind gusts, the swarm sinks, hangs near the ground. Then it rises up again once the wind dies down.
This is emergent behavior?
Right. Nobody programmed it.
He bit his lip.
Was he lying again?
So you're telling me it's learned...
Right, right.
How can it learn? The agents have no memory.
Well, that's a long story, Ricky said.
They have memory?
Yes, they have memory. Limited. We built it in.
Ricky pressed the button on his radio.
Anybody hear anything?
The answers came back, crackling in his handset.
Not yet.
Nothing.
No sounds?
Not yet. I said to Ricky,
it makes sounds? We're not sure. Sometimes it seems like it. We've been trying to record it.
He flicked keys on the workstation, quickly shifting the monitor images, making them larger, one after another. He shook his head.
I don't like this. That thing can't be alone, he said. I want to know where the others are.
How do you know there are others?
Because there always are.
He chewed his lip tensely as he looked at the monitor.
I wonder what it's up to now.
We didn't have long to wait.
In a few moments, the black swarm had come within a few yards of the building. Abruptly, it divided in two, and then divided again. Now there were three swarms, swirling side by side.
Son of a bitch, Ricky said. It was hiding the others inside itself.
He pushed his button again.
Guys, we got all three, and they're close.
They were, in fact, too close to be seen by the ground view camera. Ricky switched to the overhead views. I saw three black clouds, all moving laterally along the side of the building. The behavior seemed distinctly purposeful.
What are they trying to do? I said.
Get inside, Ricky said.
Why?
You'd have to ask them. But yesterday, one of them...
Suddenly, from a clump of cactus near the building, a cottontail rabbit sprinted away across the desert floor. Immediately, the three swarms turned and pursued it. Ricky switched the monitor view. We now watched at ground level. The three clouds converged on the terrified bunny, which was moving fast, a whitish blur on the screen. The clouds swirled after it with surprising speed. The behavior was clear. They were hunting. I felt a moment of irrational pride. Pred prey was working perfectly.
Those swarms might as well be lionesses chasing a gazelle, so purposeful was their behavior. The swarms turned sharply, then split up, cutting off the rabbit's escape to the left and right. The behavior of the three clouds clearly appeared coordinated. Now they were closing in. And suddenly, one of the swarms sank down, engulfing the rabbit. The other two swarms fell on it moments later. The resulting particle cloud was so dense it was hard to see the rabbit anymore. Apparently it had flipped onto its back, because I saw its hind legs kicking spasmodically in the air above the cloud itself. I said, "They're killing it."
"Yeah," Ricky said, nodding.
"That's right." I thought this was a camera swarm.
"Yeah, well, how are they killing it?"
"We don't know, Jack, but it's fast."
I frowned.
"So you've seen this before?"
Ricky hesitated, bit his lip, didn't answer me, just stared at the screen.
I said, "Ricky, you've seen this before?"
He gave a long sigh.
"Yeah. Well, the first time was yesterday. They killed a rattlesnake yesterday."
I thought, "They killed a rattlesnake yesterday."
I said, "Jesus, Ricky."
I thought of the men in the helicopter talking about all the dead animals. I wondered if Ricky was telling me all he knew.
"Yeah."
The rabbit no longer kicked. A single protruding foot trembled with small convulsions, and then was still. The cloud swirled low to the ground around the animal, rising and falling slightly. This continued for almost a minute. I said, "What are they doing now?"
Ricky shook his head.
"I'm not sure, but they did this before, too.
It almost looks like they're eating it."
"I know,"
Ricky said. Of course, that was absurd. Pred prey was just a biological analogy. As I watched the pulsing cloud, it occurred to me that this behavior might actually represent a program hang. I couldn't remember exactly what rules we had written for individual units after the goal was attained. Real predators, of course, would eat their prey, but there was no analogous behavior for these micro-robots. So perhaps the cloud was just swirling in confusion. If so, it should start moving again soon. Usually, when a distributed intelligence program stalled, it was a temporary phenomenon. Sooner or later, random environmental influences would cause enough units to act that they induced all the others to act, too. Then the program would start up again. The units would resume goal-seeking. This behavior was roughly what you saw in a lecture hall after the lecture was over. The audience milled around for a while, stretching, talking to people close to them, or greeting friends, collecting coats and belongings. Only a few people left at once, and the main crowd ignored them. But after a certain percentage of the audience had gone, the remaining people would stop milling and begin to leave quickly. It was a kind of focus change. If I was right, then I should see something similar in the behavior of the cloud. The swirls should lose their coordinated appearance. There should be ragged wisps of particles rising into the air. Only then would the main cloud move. I glanced at the time clock in the corner of the monitor. "How long has it been now?"
"About 2 minutes."
That wasn't particularly long for a stall, I thought. At one point, when we were writing Pred Prey, we used the computer to simulate coordinated agent behavior. We always restarted after a hang, but finally we decided to wait and see if the program was really permanently stalled. We found that the program might hang for as long as 12 hours before suddenly kicking off and coming back to life again. In fact, that behavior interested the neuroscientists because...
"They're starting,"
Ricky said. And they were. The swarms were beginning to rise up from the dead rabbit. I saw at once that my theory was wrong. There was no raggedness, no rising wisps. The three clouds rose up together, smoothly.
The behavior seemed entirely non-random and controlled. The clouds swirled separately for a moment, then merged into one. Sunlight flashed on shimmering silver. The rabbit lay motionless on its side. And then the swarm moved swiftly away, whooshing off into the desert. It shrank toward the horizon. In moments, it was gone. Ricky was watching me. What do you think? You've got a breakaway robotic nanoswarm that some idiot made self-powered and self-sustaining. You think we can get it back? No, I said. From what I've seen, there's not a chance in hell. Ricky sighed, then shook his head. But you can certainly get rid of it, I said. You can kill it.
We can?
Absolutely.
Really?
His face brightened.
Absolutely.
And I meant it. I was convinced that Ricky was overstating the problem he faced. He hadn't thought it through. He hadn't done all he could do. I was confident that I could destroy the runaway swarm quickly. I expected that I'd be done with the whole business by dawn tomorrow, at the very latest. That was how little I understood my adversary. Day 6, 10:11 a.m. In retrospect, I was right about one thing. It was vitally important to know how the rabbit had died. Of course, I know the reason now. I also know why the rabbit was attacked. But that first day at the laboratory, I didn't have the faintest notion of what had happened, and I could never have guessed the truth. None of us could have at that point. Not even Ricky. Not even Julia. It was 10 minutes after the swarms had gone, and we were all standing in the storage room. The whole group had gathered there, tense and anxious. They watched me as I clipped a radio transmitter to my belt and pulled the headset over my head. The headset included a video camera mounted by my left ear. It took a while to get the video transmitter working right. Ricky said,
"You're really going out there?"
"I am," I said. "I want to know what happened to that rabbit." I turned to the others. "Who's coming with me?" Nobody moved. Bobby Lundbeck stared at the floor, hands in his pockets. David Brooks blinked rapidly and looked away. Ricky was inspecting his fingernails. I caught Rosie Castro's eye. She shook her head.
"No fucking way, Jack."
"Why not, Rosie?"
"You saw it yourself. They're hunting."
"Are they?"
"Sure as hell looked like it."
"Rosie," I said, "I trained you better than this. How can the swarms be hunting?"
"We all saw it."
She stuck her chin out stubbornly.
"All three of the swarms, hunting coordinated."
"But how?" I said. Now she frowned, looking confused.
"What are you asking? There's no mystery. The agents can communicate. They can each generate an electrical signal."
"Right," I said. "How big a signal?"
"Well,"
she shrugged. "How big, Rosie? It can't be much. The agent is only 1/100th of the thickness of a human hair. Can't be generating much of a signal, right?"
"True."
"And the electromagnetic radiation decays according to the square of the radius, right?" Every school kid learned that fact in high school physics. As you moved away from the electromagnetic source, the strength faded fast, very fast. And what that meant was the individual agents could only communicate with their immediate neighbors, with agents very close to them, not to other swarms 20 or 30 yards away. Rosie's frown deepened. The whole group was frowning now, looking at each other uneasily. David Brooks coughed.
"Then what did we see, Jack?"
"You saw an illusion," I said firmly. "You saw three swarms acting independently, and you thought they were coordinated. But they're not.
and I'm pretty certain that other things you believe about these swarms aren't true either. There was a lot I didn't understand about the swarms, and a lot I didn't believe. I didn't believe, for example, that the swarms were reproducing. I thought Ricky and the others must be pretty unnerved even to imagine it. After all, the 50 pounds of material they'd exhausted into the environment could easily account for the 3 swarms I had seen, and dozens more besides. I was guessing that each swarm consisted of 3 pounds of nanoparticles. That was roughly the weight of a large bee swarm. As for the fact that these swarms showed purposeful behavior, that was not in the least troubling. It was the intended result of low-level programming. And I didn't believe the swarms were coordinated. It simply wasn't possible, because the fields were too weak. Nor did I believe the swarms had the adaptive powers that Ricky attributed to them. I'd seen too many demos of robots carrying out some task, like cooperating to push a box around the room, which was interpreted by observers as intelligent behavior, when in fact the robots were stupid, minimally programmed, and cooperating by accident. A lot of behavior looked smarter than it was. As Charlie Davenport used to say, "Ricky should thank God for that." And finally, I didn't really believe that the swarms were dangerous. I didn't think that a 3-pound cloud of nanoparticles could represent much of a threat to anything, not even a rabbit. I wasn't at all sure it had been killed. I seem to recall that rabbits were nervous creatures, prone to die of fright. Or the pursuing particles might have swarmed in through the nose and mouth, blocking the respiratory passages and choking the animal to death. If so, the death was accidental, not purposeful. Accidental death made more sense to me. In short, I thought that Ricky and the others had consistently misinterpreted what they saw. They'd spooked themselves. On the other hand, I had to admit that several unanswered questions nagged at me. The first and most obvious was why the swarm had escaped their control. The original camera swarm was designed to be controlled by an RF transmitter, beaming toward it. Now, apparently, the swarm ignored transmitted radio commands, and I didn't understand why. I suspected an error in manufacturing. The particles had probably been made incorrectly. Second was the question of the swarm's longevity. The individual particles were extremely small, subject to damage from cosmic rays, photochemical decay, dehydration of their protein chains, and other environmental factors. In the harsh desert, all the swarms should have shriveled up and died of old age many days ago. But they hadn't. Why not? Third, there was the problem of the swarm's apparent goal. According to Ricky, the swarms kept coming back to the main building. Ricky believed they were trying to get inside, but that didn't seem to be a reasonable agent goal. And I wanted to look at the program code to see what was causing it. Frankly, I suspected a bug in the code. And finally, I wanted to know why they had pursued the rabbit. Because PredPrey didn't program units to become literal predators. It merely used a predator model to keep the agents focused and goal-oriented. Somehow, that had changed, and the swarms now appeared to be actually hunting. Too was probably a bug in the code. To my mind, all these uncertainties came down to a single central question. How had the rabbit died? I didn't think it had been killed. I suspected the rabbit's death was accidental, not purposeful. But we needed to find out. I adjusted my portable radio headset with the sunglasses and the video camera mounted by the left eye. I picked up the plastic bag for the rabbit's body and turned to the others. "Anybody coming with me?" There was an uncomfortable silence. Ricky said, "What's the bag for?" "To bring the rabbit back in." "No fucking way," Ricky said. "You want to go out there, that's your business, but you're not bringing that rabbit back here." You've got to be kidding, I said.
I'm not. We run a level 6 clean environment here, Jack. That rabbit's filthy. Can't come in.
All right, then. We can store it in May's lab. And
no way, Jack. Sorry. It's not coming through the first airlock.
I looked at the others. They were all nodding their heads in agreement.
All right, then. I'll examine it out there.
You're really going to go out?
Why not?
I looked at them one after another.
I have to tell you guys, I think you've all got your knickers in a twist. The cloud's not dangerous. And yes, I'm going out.
I turned to May.
Do you have a dissection kit of some kind that...
I'll come with you, she said quietly.
Okay, thanks.
I was surprised that May was the first to come around to my way of seeing things. But as a field biologist, she was probably better than the others at assessing real-world risk. In any case, her decision seemed to break some tension in the room. The others visibly relaxed. May went off to get the dissecting tools and some lab equipment. That was when the phone rang. Vince answered it and turned to me.
You know somebody named Dr. Ellen Foreman?
Yes.
It was my sister.
She's on the line.
Vince handed me the phone and stepped back.
I felt suddenly nervous. I glanced at my watch. It was 11 o'clock in the morning, time for Amanda's morning nap. She should be asleep in her crib by now. Then I remembered. I had promised my sister I would call her at 11 to check in to see how things were going. I said,
Hello, Ellen? Is everything all right?
Sure, fine.
A long, long sigh.
It's fine. I don't know how you do it, is all.
Tired?
About as tired as I've ever felt.
Kids get off to school okay?
Another sigh. Yes, in the car, Eric hit Nicole on the back, and she punched him on the ear.
You've got to interrupt them if they start that, Ellen.
So I'm learning, she said wearily.
And the baby, how's her rash?
Better. I'm using the ointment.
Her movement's okay?
Sure. She's well coordinated for her age. Is there a problem I should know about?
No, I said. I turned away from the group, lowered my voice.
I meant, is she pooping okay?
Behind me, I heard Charlie Davenport snicker.
Copiously, Ellen said. She's sleeping now. I took her to the park for a while. She was ready to go down. Everything's okay at the house, except the pilot for the water heater went out, but the guy's coming to fix it.
Good, good.
Listen, Ellen, I'm in the middle of something here. Jack, Julia called from the hospital a few minutes ago. She was looking for you.
Uh-huh.
When I said you'd gone to Nevada, she got pretty upset.
Is that right?
She said you didn't understand, and you were going to make it worse, something like that. I think you better call her. She sounded agitated.
Okay, I'll call.
How are things going out there? You'll be back tonight?
Not tonight, I said. Sometime tomorrow morning. Ellen, I have to go now.
Call the kids at dinner time if you can. They'd like to hear from you. Auntie Ellen is fine, but she's not Dad. You know what I mean?
Okay. You'll eat at 6?
About.
I told her I'd try to call. And I hung up.
May and I were standing by the double glass walls of the outer airlock, just inside the building entrance. Beyond the glass, I could see the solid steel fire door that led outside. Ricky was standing beside us, gloomy and nervous, watching as we made our final preparations.
You sure this is necessary, to go outside?
It's essential.
Why don't you and May wait until nightfall and go out then?
Because the rabbit won't be there, I said. By nightfall, coyotes or hawks will have come and taken the carcass away.
I don't know about that, Ricky said. We haven't seen any coyotes around here for a while.
Oh, hell, I said impatiently, turning on my radio headset. In the time we spent arguing about this, we could have been out and back already. See you, Ricky.
I went through the glass door and stood in the airlock. The door hissed shut behind me. The air handlers whooshed briefly in the now familiar pattern, and then the far glass slid open. I walked toward the steel fire door. Looking back, I saw May stepping into the airlock. I opened the fire door, a crack. Harsh, glaring sunlight laid a burning strip on the floor. I felt hot air on my face. Over the intercom, Ricky said, "Good luck, guys." I took a breath, pushed the door wider, and stepped out into the desert. The wind had dropped, and the mid-morning heat was stifling. Somewhere a bird chittered, otherwise it was silent. Standing by the door, I squinted in the glare of the sunlight. A shiver ran down my back. I took another deep breath. I was certain that the swarms were not dangerous, but now that I was outside, my theoretical inferences seemed to lose force. I must have caught Ricky's tension, because I was feeling distinctly uneasy. Now that I was outside, the rabbit carcass looked much farther away than I had imagined. It was perhaps 50 yards from the door, half the length of a football field. The surrounding desert seemed barren and exposed. I scanned the shimmering horizon, looking for black shapes. I saw none. The fire door opened behind me, and May said,
"Ready when you are, Jack."
"Then let's do it." We set off toward the rabbit, feet crunching on the desert sand. We moved away from the building. Almost immediately, my heart began to pound, and I started to sweat. I forced myself to breathe deeply and slowly, working to stay calm. The sun was hot on my face. I knew I had let Ricky spook me, but I couldn't seem to help it. I kept glancing toward the horizon. May was a couple of steps behind me. I said, "How are you doing?"
"I'll be glad when it's over."
We were moving through a field of knee-high yellow chola cactus. Their spines caught the sun. Here and there, a large barrel cactus stuck up from the floor like a bristling green thumb. Some small silent birds hopped on the ground beneath the chola. As we approached, they took to the air, wheeling specks against the blue. They landed 100 yards away. At last, we came to the rabbit, surrounded by a buzzing black cloud. Startled, I hesitated a step.
"It's just flies," May said.
She moved forward and crouched down beside the carcass, ignoring the flies. She pulled on a pair of rubber gloves and handed me a pair to put on. She placed a square sheet of plastic on the ground, securing it with a rock at each corner. She lifted the rabbit and set it down in the center of the plastic. She unzipped a little dissection kit and laid it open. I saw steel instruments glinting in sunlight. Forceps, scalpel, several kinds of scissors. She also laid out a syringe and several rubber-topped test tubes in a row. Her movements were quick, practiced. She had done this before. I crouched down beside her. The carcass had no odor. Externally, I could see no sign of what had caused the death. The staring eye looked pink and healthy. May said,
"Bobby, are you recording me?"
Over the headset, I heard Bobby Lembeck say, "Move your camera down." May touched the camera mounted on her sunglasses.
"Little more. Little more.
Good, that's enough."
"Okay,"
May said. She turned the rabbit's body over in her hands, inspecting it from all sides. She dictated swiftly.
"On external examination, the animal appears entirely normal. There is no sign of congenital anomaly or disease. The fur is thick and healthy in appearance. The nasal passages appear partially or entirely blocked. I note some fecal material excreted by the anus, but presume that is normal evacuation at the time of death."
She flipped the animal onto its back and held the forepaws apart with her hands.
"I need you, Jack."
She wanted me to hold the paws for her. The carcass was still warm, and had not begun to stiffen. She took the scalpel and swiftly cut down the exposed midsection. A red gash opened. Blood flowed. I saw bones of the ribcage and pinkish coils of intestine. Mays spoke continuously as she cut, noting the tissue color and texture. She said to me, "Hold here," and I moved my one hand down to hold aside the slick intestine. With a single stroke of the scalpel, she sliced open the stomach. Muddy green liquid spilled out, and some pulpy material that seemed to be undigested fiber. The inner wall of the stomach appeared roughened, but May said that was normal. She ran her finger expertly around the stomach wall, then paused.
Look there," she said.
"What?"
"There,"
she pointed. In several places, the stomach was reddish, bleeding slightly, as if it had been rubbed raw. I saw black patches in the midst of the bleeding.
"That's not normal," May said. "That's pathology."
She took a magnifying glass and peered closer, then dictated,
"I observe dark areas approximately 4 to 8 millimeters in diameter, which I presume to be clusters of nanoparticles present in the stomach lining," she said. "These clusters are found in association with mild bleeding of the villus wall."
"There are nanoparticles in the stomach?" I said. "How did they get there? Did the rabbit eat them, swallow them involuntarily?"
"I doubt it. I would assume they entered actively."
I frowned. "You mean they crawled down the..."
"Esophagus, yes. At least I think so."
"Why would they do that?"
"I don't know."
She never paused in her swift dissection. She took scissors and cut upward through the breastbone, then pushed the rib cage open with her fingers.
"Hold here."
I moved my hands to hold the ribs open as she had done. The edges of bone were sharp. With my other hand, I held the hind legs open. May worked between my hands.
"The lungs are bright pink and firm, normal appearance."
She cut one lobe with the scalpel, then again and again. Finally, she exposed the bronchial tube and cut it open. It was dark black on the inside.
"Bronchi show heavy infestation with nanoparticles consistent with inhalation of swarm elements," she said, dictating. "You getting this, Bobby?"
"Getting it all. Video resolution is good." She continued to cut upward.
"Following the bronchial tree toward the throat,"
and she continued cutting into the throat, and then from the nose back across the cheek, then opening the mouth. I had to turn away for a moment, but she continued calmly to dictate.
"I am observing heavy infiltration of all the nasal passages and pharynx. This is suggestive of partial or full airway obstruction, which in turn may indicate the cause of death."
I looked back.
"What?"
The rabbit's head was hardly recognizable any longer. She had cut the jaw free and was now peering down the throat.
"Have a look for yourself,"
she said.
"There seems to be dense particles closing the pharynx, and a response that looks something like an allergic reaction or..."
Then Ricky.
"Say, are you guys going to stay out much longer?"
"As long as it takes," I said. I turned to May. "What kind of allergic reaction?"
"Well," she said, "you can see this area of tissue and how swollen it is. And you see how it's turned gray, which is suggestive..."
"You realize," Ricky said, "that you've been out there 4 minutes already?"
"We're only out here because we can't bring the rabbit back," I said.
"That's right, you can't."
May was shaking her head as she listened to this.
"Ricky, you're not helping here,"
Bobby said. "Don't shake your head, May. You're moving the camera back and forth."
"Sorry."
But I saw her raise her head as if she was looking toward the horizon, and while she did so, she uncorked the test tube and slipped a slice of stomach lining into the glass. She put it in her pocket, then looked back down. No one watching the video would have seen what she did.
she said.
All right, we'll take blood samples now.
Blood's all you're bringing in here, guys, Ricky said.
Yes, Ricky, we know.
May reached for the syringe, stuck the needle into an artery, drew a blood sample, expelled it into a plastic tube, popped the needle off one-handed, put on another, and drew a second sample from a vein. Her pace never slowed. I said,
I have the feeling you've done this before. This is nothing. In Sichuan, we were always working in heavy snowstorms. You can't see what you're doing. Your hands are freezing, the animal's frozen solid, can't get a needle in.
She set the tubes of blood aside.
Now we will take a few cultures, and we're done.
She flipped over her case, looked.
Oh, bad luck.
What's that? I said.
The culture swabs aren't here.
But you have them inside?
Yes, I'm sure of it.
I said, Ricky, you see the swabs anywhere?
Yes, they're right here by the airlock.
You want to bring them out to us?
Oh, sure, guys.
He laughed harshly.
No way I'm going out there in daylight. You want them, you come get them.
May said to me,
you want to go?
No, I said. I was already holding the animal open. My hands were in position. I'll wait here. You go.
Okay.
She got to her feet.
Try and keep the flies off. We don't want any more contamination than necessary. I'll be back in a moment.
She moved off at a light jog toward the door. I heard her footsteps fade, then the clang of the metal door shutting behind her. Then, silence. Attracted by the slid-open carcass, the flies came back in force, buzzing around my head, trying to land on the exposed guts. I released the rabbit's hind legs and swatted the flies away with one hand. I kept myself busy with the flies, so I wouldn't think about the fact that I was alone out here. I kept glancing off in the distance, but I never saw anything. I kept brushing away the flies, and occasionally my hand touched against the rabbit's fur, and that was when I noticed that beneath the fur, the skin was bright red. Bright red. Exactly like a bad sunburn. Just seeing it made me shiver. I spoke into my headset. Bobby? Crackle.
Yes, Jack.
Can you see the rabbit?
Yes, Jack.
You see the redness of the skin? Are you picking that up?
Just a minute.
I heard a soft whir by my temple. Bobby was controlling the camera remotely, zooming in. The whirring stopped. I said, can you see this through my camera? There was no answer.
Bobby?
I heard murmurs, whispers, or maybe it was static.
Bobby, are you there?
Silence. I heard breathing.
Jack?
Now it was the voice of David Brooks.
You better go in.
May hasn't come back yet. Where is she?
May is inside.
Well, I have to wait. She's going to do cultures.
No, come in now, Jack.
I let go of the rabbit and got to my feet. I looked around, scanned the horizon.
I don't see anything.
They're on the other side of the building, Jack. His voice was calm, but I felt a chill.
They are?
Come inside now, Jack. I bent over, picked up May's samples, her dissection kit lying beside the rabbit carcass. The black leather of the kit was hot from the sun.
Jack?
Just a minute.
Jack, stop fucking around.
I started toward the steel door, my feet crunching on the desert floor. I didn't see anything at all. But I heard something. It was a peculiar, low, thrumming sound. At first, I thought I was hearing machinery, but the sound rose and fell, pulsing like a heartbeat. Other beats were superimposed, along with some kind of hissing, creating a strange, unworldly quality, like nothing I'd ever heard. When I look back on it now, I think that more than anything else, It was the sound that made me afraid.